This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the Secretary of Defense raises warnings about Iran and who's dying in Iraq. Just two of the subjects we'll tackle here on today's roundtable. From our headquarters in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Yvonne Bino, author of Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and the Hip-Hop Culture. Also joining us, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. He comes to us today from Maryland. And with me here in the New York Bureau, Jeff Obafemi Carr. He's founding artistic director of the Amun-Ra Theater. Folks, before we get into Mr. Rumsfeld's latest warnings, let's talk a little bit about what we just heard, George Curry. When you hear about Watts, and I think of other cities, Detroit and Newark, who went up in flames in the 60s, and out of those ashes, many people had hoped these cities would rise like the Phoenix and give a new day to African Americans. One has to look at the lot of African Americans who live currently in those flashpoint areas and wonder, quite frankly, what all that carnage did for any of them.
Well, it's a tough thing to say. I mean, but basically, it has improved in a sense that there was that during that period an emphasis on poverty, helping people, great society programs. At least there was a national commitment to at least try. Now we see the poverty rate increasing, and from my vantage point, I don't see the same commitment. Every politician that ran for president last time, including the black ones, talking about what you can do for the middle class, and rarely did you hear people say, what are we doing for the poor and the homeless? So I think the country has shifted then, but at least during that period, the American conscience was on the people who were in poverty.
Yvonne, it would be foolish to think that African-Americans in totality, haven't come a long way since 1965. Certainly we have. But disproportionately, there are still far, far too many African-Americans and people of color living in poverty today. And certainly, again, I echo the thought that certainly the numbers are still much larger than I think many people assumed they would be back in the 60s had they been able to project to today.
I would tend to agree with that. I think, as George said, that at least at that period of time, there was a national discussion about how do we alleviate poverty, how do we address the concerns of people in communities like Watts, Detroit, and New York, and the other places where there were uprisings. But I think that part of the situation that tends to lead us to today was the white flight. I think also, too, a lot of the professional black middle class left these communities, and what you were left with were people who unfortunately were not able to advocate for themselves. And as time moved on and moved on, there was less and less a concern for the voiceless. So in that last election, like George aptly put it, there was no conversation about an urban policy. Although the majority of black people still live in urban centers, there's very little conversation about race. We tend to gloss over it or have these PC discussions about it, but there are still people living in abject situations, and the black middle class is very touchy about talking about it, and white people run away from the discussion, and we really need to get back to some real brass tacks discussions. As Tim Watkins said, not talking about solving the symptoms, but actually getting to the underlying causes of poverty and getting some real urban policy on the table.
Jeff, it seems to me that the haves, whether they be black or white, have not learned the lessons of the past, and that eventually, whether it be immediate or still down the road, we are going to see poor people who are sick and tired of being sick and tired about being poor. And we may, in fact, see the same kind of carnage in the streets.
Well, indeed. And I think that's pretty prophetic, Ed. I think coming off what Yvonne was saying and, of course, what George was saying, we have to continue to talk about these things. We have to have these discussions. Poor people have proven all throughout history, the underserved, the oppressed, they have proven that although they might seem to be voiceless, eventually they are going to take a stand and make their voices heard. Over 1,000 people were injured in the Watts riot or rebellion, depending on what side of nationalism you fall on in the perspective. 30 people died, but this happened all over the place. I went to school at Tennessee State University. The 60s were a turbulent time. They're around what they call the long, hot summer. Just in an ounce of prevention measure, they went to the campus and rolled a military tank up on the middle of the campus and made all of the black men in the dormitory strip down naked. These are things that we have to talk about now, because hopefully by talking about them, we won't be doomed to repeat them.
And one of the things that I think Mr. Watkins so aptly talked about is the idea of what happens after this, because often, far too often, the communities that are burned and have to be rebuilt and typically aren't rebuilt to pre-riot stage are African-American communities, and there is no resurgence of hope and opportunity for many of these communities. So you end up just burning down your backyard because, as you say, the military comes out and draws a line in the sand that you will not cross.
Right. They think it's that you're actually it's self-destruction. But in actuality, it's as if, like, say, for instance, if you are being bothered by a wasp, you start swatting everything immediately in your periphery. You might even hit some of the people that you love because you're trying to alleviate the problem. People say, well, you know, they're tearing up their own stuff. Well, that's what they have access to. And that's what they're confined to.
Right. But also, too, I think that Mr. Watkins made a good point that the uprisings are happening all around the country still. Right here where I am in Washington, D.C. area, there are, I think, about approximately 100 young people who have been killed this year. There are homicides over about 100 in Prince George's County. We have Latino gang violence. There were 6 people stabbed recently at a mall. And to add to that, in Washington as well as PG County, which have a large number of Black people, the school systems are rated near the bottom. So there probably are some correlations that we should be looking at. They've been there for decades. And again, we keep sweeping things under the rug and doing these stopgap measures, but we need to get serious.
And PG County being Prince George's County, for those who aren't familiar with the Washington, D.C. area, suburb in Maryland. Let's turn our attention now to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who is suggesting that we should look for escalated violence as we near the referendum on a new constitution and the general elections, which will happen and are scheduled for December 15th. So he anticipates the insurgents to ramp up, if you will, the violent activity. But one of the interesting points that we're hearing from him, and it raises an interesting question here, George Curry, and that is whether or not now Iran becomes part of the quagmire we now know as the Iraqi war. Donald Rumsfeld has suggested that they are finding more weapons who are, in his words, unambiguously from Iran, found in the hands of the insurgents. And he notes that it is notably unhelpful, and this is a quote again, for the Iranians to be allowing weapons of those types to be crossing the border. As you take a look at this, George, how does this play itself out? Certainly, we can't now turn our attention militarily to Iran, can we?
Well, if we want to make a choice between Iraq and Iran, we should have picked Iran in the first place. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But we didn't do that. The other point is that he's talking about what's going to be increasing insurgency. I don't know where he's been. It's already there. We're already on an increase when we see these increasing number of deaths. I don't give much credence to this. I mean, he got to say something. And, Iran certainly has been part of it, but it's been part of it beforehand.
I would tend to agree. I'm wondering, to a certain extent, is this wag the dog, something to divert our attention from the fact that the insurgency is continuing? Anybody who's been paying attention would have seen that the kidnappings, the killings. So I think this is just his way of trying to tell the American people what they already know as a way to, temper the brewing storm. But again, I agree. You can't be everywhere. We don't have the troops. So to talk about Iran, this has been happening for a long time. So I don't see the point of bringing this up at this point.
In September 1980, the Iraq invaded Iran. From 1982 to 1988, the U.S. provided helicopters and other help and assistance to help win on Iraq's side, as George alluded to. This has been going on for a long time. This is not just happening now. Iran has always been a target here. December 20th, 1983, Rumsfeld was there shaking hands with Saddam Hussein to assist in doing something to Iran. Now, the tables have turned. I think this is a huge quagmire, and Rumsfeld tends to operate from the policy of the Bush administration, and he tends to have a script that is basically, in this case, I think, is an honest assessment. I think we are looking for some violence to take place there. That's no secret there. But I think is what happens next. What happens next? I don't think the administration knows what happens next. I think that they're dealing with the situation where they're going to be asking themselves if anybody has page 10.
Let me take us to, for those in New York, they'll know exactly what we're talking about. Listen, let me take you to something that is, if you will, 6 degrees of separation between the two topics we've talked about already. The Austin American Statesman, as part of an ongoing project to chart death rates in Iraq, has broken down for the first time who is essentially being killed in Iraq. They're looking at race, where people are from, etc. And what they have found essentially is that this war is being fought by Americans from poor rural areas, plain and simple. That seems to be the case in many, many wars, almost all of them. Yvonne, when you hear this, again, the idea that the poor seem to get the short end of the stick wherever we go in this country.
Well, I think that this study by the Austin American Statesman just basically quantifies what people already knew. I read recently where one of the military people was talking about, anonymously, of course, that Americans seem very detached from this war, that we're chanting about patriotism and stay the course, but very few of us are really engaged in this process. And that seems to be the truth. In earlier times, it was the wealthy, the well-to-do who went and, you know, were on the front line, so to speak, in terms of championing these wars. But the reverse has happened, and it's the poor who are bearing the brunt, people who want to go to school, people who have no other employment opportunities. Those are the people who are being sent to the front lines, and the people who are championing these causes, you know, really have no real involvement or engagement. So it's very easy to champion from the side when you have nothing invested in this.
Well, Yvonne, is worse than that. These are chicken hawks. They're hawks now that dodged the draft or went into reserve to get away from doing it, but they're the most ardent supporters of the war now. What this also reflects, though, is that not only are the rural soldiers making up the majority of death, they make up the majority of the military, because what it really means is because there are limited opportunity, whether they're white or poor, are black, and they're all poor, this is the majority of people who go into the military in the first place, and they are the one bearing the brunt of these deaths.
Now, I feel sorry for the people who are in this situation, because they are indeed the heartland of America. We talk about heartland, and they're the people who hold on to the traditional, quote, end quote, American values. They're the people who are small town, apple pie, wave the flag on the 4th of July, or the 4th of July, depending on where you fall again on the side of nationalism or not. But these are the people who have the hope, and because they have the hope, they are manipulated by that. There's a line in a Stephen Carter novel that says, fear turns people into sheep, and sheep respond to a good shepherd. And what happens is we have a climate of fear in the United States right now. And when the military comes as a good shepherd and says, we are going to reinforce our way of life, then the people who tend to be the sheep and have this hope follow along somewhat mindlessly. And when you contribute what George said in terms of limited employment, limited education, and we have a lot of people who are the poorest and most oppressed people with the limited opportunity laying their lives on the line.
Let me turn our attention to something that clearly is not as serious as life and death, but certainly speaks to the idea of the image of America and the image of black America, if you will. The syndicated entertainment program Access Hollywood took a look at mainstream magazines, and they did a random search of the newsstands and saw that very, very, very few African-Americans hit the covers of these magazines, most still white, blonde, and under 40 faces on these covers. Jeff, this is not a surprising. Do we take a lesson again from Spike Lee's famous movie that, you know, I own the pizza parlor and that's right. Who I'm putting on the wall?
We have to take a lesson from this and say that these things continue to exist. Should we still have the debate that W.B. Du Bois launched when he said the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line? Of course we should, because it's continuing into the 21st century. We might not want to deal with it, but in life we get what we inspect and not what we expect. So we could expect that we're going to see ourselves all over the place. But when you look at it and you look at Hollywood, you look at the magazine covers and you look at the media, you don't see us represented well in all the shades and the colors and the beauties of America. And if you don't fix that problem, then you're still going to be dealing with issues of low self-esteem and psychological problems in our youth.
Okay, but the problem is a little more complicated than this. The magazine covers are basically marketing tools. That means if you go on a newsstand, you have a couple of seconds, what's going to make you pick up that magazine? So you have to understand it from that perspective first. But having said that, it's still really indefensible that a magazine like Vanity Fair, and I can't remember the last time they had an African-American on the cover. And when you do find African-Americans on cover, you find them in the insets. They're not a single image cover line, and that's what you're really looking for. So what it really means is that that magazine editors need to take more chances. Glamour put Queen Latifah on the cover. It was one of their best sellers. They never would have known that, and they need to take chances when they're doing that. But this, don't forget, this is really about marketing tools for newsstand sales.
Well, let me throw this in, and Yvonne, pick up your point here. Some would argue, George, and you can follow up if you like, that there are others who will suggest that their statistics show when they put African Americans on the cover, barring the Queen Latifah example, that they don't sell as well, and the bottom line is about making money.
Well, I think that is a reality of business, but I think that also, too, that's been proven that, unfortunately, when you put a black person on the cover or even in many cases a dark complexion Latina, they don't sell. So, but my point is I just question whether it's better to have no blacks on the cover or everyone being a rap star or a, athlete, because, again, I don't see where the stereotype changes. There are people out there of all types. They're actresses, serious actresses, not just comedians. And we seem to get stuck in this mode that if we do get a black person, it's somebody singing and dancing or telling a joke. So I just think that part of the problem, too, is content. Big deal. Have somebody on the cover, but if you're not saying anything within the magazine, I'm not going to pick it up either. So I think it's part of it having content that will appeal to a diverse audience, not just sticking someone on the cover. And I think that we need to get more into the content of these magazines as well.
George, with
about
30 seconds.
I don't subscribe to the notion that blacks don't sell on the cover. It's just you got to pick the person who's most likely going to appeal to the largest audience. And even when you're picking the stars on some of these magazines, they won't even put Denzel, Halle Berry, or any others on there. So it's just a serious problem. And certainly they could have been on the cover of Vanity Fair.
Well, and certainly the one who flies in the face of all that is Oprah, who we see every month on the cover of her magazine. And they've asked her,
you know she's going to be on the cover.
They ask her, hey, why don't you put somebody else on? He says, because they don't sell like me. So there you go. All right. Yvonne, George, Jeff, thanks so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Ed.